This is Andrew Peach with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Good to have you with us. As the number of people killed in that flooding in Spain rises above 200, we'll have the latest on the clear-up operation in Valencia. With 4 days until the US election, the opinion polls are neck and neck. But who do the markets think is going to win? We'll hear from South Sudan, the world's youngest country, facing a deep economic crisis.
Since 2011, since the independence of South Sudan, oil revenues have declined by about 72%. We're already seeing a potential move to a post-oil economy in both Sudan and South Sudan, but the pipelines are still extremely important.
And the cartoon cat worth $7 billion.
It was printed on a small purse along with about six other different character products. Hello Kitty far outsold the others.
Don't forget you can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, plus 44 330 678 3033, or drop us an email to world.business@bbc.co.uk. First to Spain, where more than 200 people are now known to have died in flash flooding. Dozens more are missing, mainly in Valencia, after rising waters left people trapped in their homes and workplaces. Thousands of volunteers have joined the Spanish military and emergency services to deal with the rescue and clear-up operation. Our correspondent in Valencia is Nikki Schiller.
They say in disasters you see the best and the worst of people. This is the best. Hundreds and hundreds of people have come into this area. I'm in the city of Valencia and the worst part of the city. Now, this is a fruit and veg shop. All along here are the boxes and there's fruit in there covered in the dirty mud. And the volunteers have been here pushing this muddy water down into the drains here. So businesses are really affected here. There's a bar down the end of this street. Again, it's been trying to get rid of this mud. It is everywhere. It's over me. It's over everyone in this city. If there is further rain, then this mud is going to get even worse. But locals coming together to try and do what they can.
Let's go live to our correspondent, Nikki Schiller, now. Nikki, you've been talking to more business owners about trying to rescue their livelihoods, trying to save their premises.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. I'm actually sitting on the pavement, and opposite me is what you would describe as one of those sort of little family bars. You know, it's not a big chain. It's just somewhere that you would, if you were in this neighbourhood, maybe pop in for a drink. I can see Amstel written on the outside. And they, earlier on, were bringing out their equipment and trying to hose it down. There are chairs that, of course, you would sit on, the bar stools, all just covered in this awful mud that is absolutely everywhere. And you see that street after street where businesses, I just went past a restaurant and, you know, normally they would have the tables and chairs outside for visitors because this is a tourist area. The chairs and tables were outside, but they were piled up and covered in mud, and they haven't got any power. So even if they wanted to try and serve some food, which would be difficult, there isn't any power in this area to be able to cook anything, let alone things like have a shower or do anything like that. And all of the businesses that you see earlier on today, I was standing waiting to broadcast on TV, and we were standing next to what was corrugated iron, obviously a business or a storeroom. And the owner came up and literally burst into tears in front of us because he was opening up his business and just seeing water everywhere, muddy water. I have to say, I mentioned the good in that little clip that you played, within about half an hour, there has been an army of people here today with brooms and buckets and spades. And they came in and started helping to try and get that muddy water out of his premises. And that's what's been happening. The local community coming to help the local businesses that are in this area. Yesterday, we were talking to a business owner. At that point, it was when there was a lot of tension, actually, because of concerns about whether there was a big enough effort from the authorities. And this business owner was worried about looting, the fact that people might go into her shop and steal things. Then there were about 39 arrests, but luckily that doesn't seem to have happened on a wide scale at all, because I think people are just honestly so shocked at what has happened. But that is the sort of feeling that is here from the business owners. And you see them in their shops trying to clear up. We were walking past the kite shop here, which is, you know, one of those places that tourists might go in and get a backpack or a T-shirt with a logo on. And we went in and caught up with the manager, Demery, and here's what she had to say to us.
I have hope. You know, I'm waiting that we can return. We can receive the money back. I hope that.
Do you have insurance?
Yes, I have.
And are you hopeful that that will pay out for some of the damage?
I don't know. I am not sure because, you know, now I have a good security. But the problem is, for example, now we growing and we receive the new merchandise. And, you know, the business is growing. It's more than the security. I'm not sure if I am going to receive everything, all the damage, but I don't know.
Do you have any idea of the cost that this will incur on you?
For example, only I can tell you about my stock. I have one stock around 200 million euro. But I don't know exactly the damage now, because you can see that the store, everything is damaged.
And you had a car in the front of your store?
Car, yes, but not my car. It was the car of one people. It was in the front of my, in the glass of my store. And for that reason, the store, it was open.
And also, there's wood in here that has now been covered in water, hasn't it?
Yeah. Everything is damaged. I hope, I don't know, in 2 months or 3 months we can go open again.
So you really think you could be open in 3 months' time?
I think so. I hope.
Thanks to Demery for talking to us. We've also been speaking to Javier Leon, who runs a bookshop called Librolandia, just outside Valencia.
It's all destroyed. The stands all turned over. The water has flooded everything. Imagine the situation. It's devastating to see this. It caught us all by surprise. It came out of nowhere. We only got 20 minutes' notice. My street was a commercial street. There was a corner shop, jewellers, Chinese bazaars, restaurants. It's all gone. All of it. Gone. All our businesses are in my situation. There's a pile-up of cars up to 6 cars high. In my shop, the water reaches up to 2.60 meters. Honestly, nobody could have imagined this.
Back to our correspondent, Nikki Schiller. Nikki, while people are starting to clear up where you are, elsewhere in Spain, it's a different story.
Yeah, absolutely. There are still weather alerts in force, amber alerts. One of the red ones has now been downgraded, but this is a worry for the authorities that if there is more rain, there could be more flooding and more businesses damaged. I think, though, as you heard from Demery, there is hope, but I think it's going to be a long time. This is not days, weeks or months. I think it's going to be years before this area can get back to what it was like before the flooding, Andrew.
Nikki, thank you very much indeed. Now, the latest big data drop before the US election is in. Let's go through it with Shanti Kellerman, who's Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. We're talking about a net gain of 12,000 jobs in a month, but to put that in context, the previous month it was 223,000, Shanti. So the number of jobs created, pretty disappointing.
A bit disappointing, but there were a lot of mitigating factors this time. So we had the hurricanes Helene and Milton, also had the Boeing strikes, which have taken a big, you know, I think it's 38,000 workers out from that. And when you look at the market today, there hasn't been a huge reaction to it. I think people realize that that data is probably a little bit unreliable for the month. Yeah, it doesn't look great, but we've seen huge swings lately from month to month, big revisions with, you know, the previous month's data is being changed. So I don't think people are taking this too badly in the market today.
Sure. In terms of whether it affects how people vote in a US presidential election in a few days' time, anyone's guess, I suppose. But we're still on track for the Fed to cut rates next week, though.
Yeah. So if you look at the market, they are still pricing in that we'll have probably two rate rises, so not 0.5% lower by the end of the year. We should get 0.25% this month. So that hasn't changed in the market as a result of this data.
Okay, the labour market cooling. We'll talk a bit more in a few minutes' time. We are 4 days away from that election. It is the job of hedge fund managers to predict what's going to happen so they can make good decisions for their clients. So are the markets pointing to victory for either Kamala Harris or Donald Trump? Speaking on the podcast Political Currency, the former UK Finance Minister George Osborne said although the polls say it's too close to call, the markets are pretty clear they're anticipating a Trump win.
I've just come back from Riyadh, where they have a big event called the FII, which is sort of dubbed to the Davos in the desert. And you get all the big company chief executives and the big Wall Street figures there. And the money is saying Trump's won. And it's not just in the betting markets, but the US stock market has risen pretty substantially in the last couple of weeks. And some stocks of sectors that people think will do well under Trump, at least in the short term, because he won't be as regulatory as the Democrats. He'll take off regulations or point to the key Washington regulators, people who are more capitalist, if you like. Those stocks are doing well. So you might notice that some of the tech stocks have really done well in the last couple of weeks. Bitcoin has done incredibly well because Trump is seen as being more pro the crypto industry than Kamala Harris. So the money is all now flowing towards Trump. And if Trump doesn't win, then there'll be quite a big kind of market correction.
The former UK Chancellor George Osborne. Let's talk to Tom Sosnoff now, founder of Tasty Live, which offers market analysis to hundreds of thousands of subscribers every week. Tom, do you think George Osborne has got it right when he says the markets think Trump is going to win it next week?
Well, the bond market for sure thinks Trump is going to win it. The bond market's been very heavy here, and I think that's all in anticipation or fear of what Trump's policies may do with respect to bonds. The stock market's kind of tracking the betting markets in the U.S., so there's a slight edge to Trump right here. I'm not as convinced that the stock market won't sell off if Trump wins. I think there's just as much risk of a sell-off due to a Trump win as there is to a Harris win. But I think that the bond market's made the most kind of complete statement.
How do markets know? I mean, it's the job of people who are trading to know what's going to happen, to anticipate
they
it. But how do they work it out? How do they give it their best shot at knowing?
It's called efficient market theory. But the markets actually don't know. It's the totality of all the dollars that flow into the market, and it's the reaction of all those dollars together. It's everybody watching the exact same movie and then making a decision on their own. And it's the totality of that decision that's kind of what leads people to think that the markets know. I mean, the markets know just from the money flow, but any individual, nobody has a clue.
And what do investors do as a result if they want to read the market, think, yeah, this is what we think is going to happen? What do you then do with your investments ahead of the election to try and be ready for the result?
Well, I think that the smart investors take a contrarian approach and they look at it opportunistically. Like if the bond markets had a huge sell-off, maybe you want to buy bonds here or you want to bet that interest rates will go a little bit lower. The stock markets had a huge rally. Maybe you want to take the other side of that bet and bet that maybe prices will get cheaper before they get more expensive. So I like the contrarian approach here. I think you fade the public money flow.
And would you be advising your subscribers to do anything now with their investments when, every other indication away from the stock market suggests that no one really knows, it's too close to call, we don't know what's going to happen?
Well, I definitely think that nobody knows anything, so that's for sure. But I do like certain things. Like, I do like the bonds at these levels. I do like currencies here. I like anything but the U.S. dollar. So I think there are things that are kind of oversold, and in the case of most currencies, in the case of the bond market. And I do think that there are certain sectors in the stock market that are very overbought. You got to be careful about it. It's as much of what are the pot odds telling us more than what is the market telling us. Like, where are you going to get the most asymmetric opportunity for the least amount of money right now? And I think that's what people should be looking at.
Great to talk to you, Tom. Thank you for coming on World Business Report. That's Tom Sosnoff from Tasty Live. This is Andrew Peach on the BBC World Service. And we're going to talk about South Sudan now, which is the world's youngest country, but it's facing one of the world's worst economic crises. It broke away from Sudan in 2011 after decades of civil war. It's now facing a collapsing currency, high inflation, a catastrophic fall-off in revenue from oil. Back in 2011, Fergus Nicol went to South Sudan in the run-up to its independence, listening to the stories of returning exiles, soldiers who were desperate to get back to their family farms, and young people looking to return home.
There's a big crowd bustling around the tailgate of this huge truck as they try to get their possessions on board. There's a kid over there with a satellite dish on her head. There's a young woman with a hubbly-bubbly water pipe. But they've got their family stuff as well. Clothes in big suitcases, nylon carpets. And they're crowding around, determined to get all their stuff into the back so they can make it to some kind of secure and dry accommodation tonight. This is not quite the end of a very, very long return journey from the north to South Sudan.
He was saying the journey was okay. They were very happy because they're coming to their motherland. And they were very happy. There's not any problem when they're coming.
We came in difficult conditions.
How long do you expect the government to take care of you here in Juba till you can find your job and your house?
Government, you know everything. And we are here because they told us when we are left in Khartoum, they said that they will supply us with everything. So if they failed totally, it is not okay. It is sort of abuse.
So that was the situation in South Sudan, as reported on World Business Report in 2011. What's going on there now? Nikki Kindersley from Cardiff University is an expert on South Sudan's economy. I spoke to her earlier from Juba.
The transport routes up to the north were obviously part of the reason for the civil wars in the Sudans before 2005, but also the reason partly for the ending of the war in 2005, because everybody wanted to secure access to oil production reliably. And now, since 2011, since the independence of South Sudan, oil revenues have declined by about 72% in most estimates in South Sudan. So we're already seeing a potential move to a post-oil economy in both Sudan and South Sudan, but the pipelines are still extremely important.
So explain why the oil industry in South Sudan has declined so much.
There's been a number of dynamics here. South Sudan's oil has already got a very short lifespan, right? We're only expecting, with the known reserves, about 15 more years of oil production. So even with the start of the civil war in 2013, the government in South Sudan was already selling oil futures and advanced consignments. It had also monetized the national deficit already. So the collapse of oil revenue prices, the sale of oil futures, and the possibility of running out of oil reserves have all contributed to a growing sense of crisis in the South Sudan oil industry very, very quickly.
So I guess rather than trying to fix it, the game is to try and replace it as a source of income with something else. But what might that something else be?
This is the big question. The suspension of oil exports northwards has really sped up this question of what next. But to be honest, South Sudan is already becoming one of the first post-oil economies in the world. It's just been accelerated by the war in Sudan. And what we're seeing in South Sudan is a turn towards the commodification and commercialization of other extractables, right? And this can be everything from looking for gold reserves. There's also more prospecting for other minerals. And there's an increasing focus on agricultural outputs and large commercial farming.
And how does the government keep the economy going while this process goes on, while they look for what the future is going to be?
Well, this is a really big question because actually, in some respects, for the majority of people in South Sudan, the economy is not keeping going. The civil service across South Sudan has not been paid since November 2023. Otherwise, the economy is also collapsing. There's been extreme inflation, particularly hyperinflation in mid-2015 when the civil war restarted here, but increasing inflation over this last year in particular, with the war in Sudan, which has dramatically raised the cost of living for everyone across the country.
And what does that mean in terms of everyday life for people there, if people can't afford basic stuff?
I mean, everyone is running multiple jobs, everyone is panicking, but really this just means that people's margins are being cut to the bone.
And whatever the post-oil economy is in South Sudan, is it still going to be beholden to export routes through Sudan and therefore subject to the war that still continues there?
Yes. I mean, Sudan and South Sudan are still tied together through a really long and constantly disputed and securitized border. One of the major impacts of the Sudan war this last year is that the war began just at a time when young men and women were planning to do the seasonal migration to the north to go and get seasonal jobs in the agricultural fields in the center of Sudan. And this was a crisis for everyone, not being able to go and get the incomes, the cash incomes that are needed in South Sudan to pay for medicine, for school fees and emergencies and so on. So there is really a significant impact. If you disrupt Sudan, you disrupt South Sudan fundamentally.
That was Nikki Kindersley with me from Juba a little earlier. Back to Shanti Kellerman from M&G Wealth. Shanti, we're talking about oil there and its importance in that part of the world. Profits at ExxonMobil and Chevron fell in the third quarter. Tell us more.
Yeah, so both those companies, they had their profits down. It was largely because oil prices have come down, which is good news for the rest of the world. Lower commodity prices means lower costs. They compensated a bit by increasing production, and they've also been able to reduce some of their costs. So both companies had better than expected results. Shares up slightly today, but not by a huge amount.
Okay. And we're still talking about billions of pounds and billions of dollars here, aren't we?
We do, yeah. And there is, you know, these companies do still make a lot of money. At present, they do still provide vital services to the global economy because it couldn't function without oil at this point in time. And a lot of them are, some of these companies are making investments in other areas. Chevron and Exxon are probably a bit behind the pack on that. But some of the other big oil majors like Shell, Total Energies are definitely trying to move in that direction and have a bit more balance in all the assets and exposures that they've got.
And let's talk about Abbott Laboratories and Reckitt Benckiser. Their shares have surged today, but why?
So both those companies have been subject to ongoing lawsuits about baby formula causing issues with newborns, which is, you know, a very emotional and sensitive subject. They had up to, I think it was over 1,000 lawsuits, $2.5 billion in claims, you know, all across the court system. And they actually had a jury rule in their favor that the risks, there weren't, you know, overdone risks that weren't disclosed in their products. So that led to a big rally in the shares, people thinking that potentially they'll be able to settle these lawsuits. They might not have to pay out as much money as otherwise feared.
Shanti, thank you. That's Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth, with me on World Business Report. Now, Hello Kitty is 50. This is a white cartoon cat adorning merch from handbags to rice cookers around the world. It's turned its creator into a trillion yen firm. That's a market capitalization of more than $7 billion. When its young chief executive, Tomo Kunisuji, took over 4 years ago, the company was struggling to make a profit, though. He told my colleague Mariko Oi how he's turned things around.
She's arguably one of Japan's best-loved creations. She's had a varied career. Animated television star, former Japanese tourism ambassador, and two-time visitor to the International Space Station. And according to Statista, as of 2021, Hello Kitty also ranks as the world's second highest grossing media franchise, behind Pokemon and ahead of US brands like Mickey Mouse and Star Wars. Hello Kitty was born when a little-known Japanese artist, Yuko Shimizu, who was working for Sanrio, put pen to paper and created a character titled Unknown White Cat. Ms. Shimizu told Witness History about creating the character.
It took a few attempts. When it was first designed, it was printed on a small purse released on sale, along with about six other different character products. However, Hello Kitty far outsold the others.
From her inception, the character was a success for Sanrio. It played on the Japanese culture of kawaii, which centered around the appeal of cuteness. According to a Forbes 2022 report, the character has reportedly generated $84.5 billion worldwide. Sanrio is also the company behind other characters like Pochako and Cinema Roll. Despite their popularity, the firm was struggling to be profitable after the most recent Hello Kitty boom in 2014 ended, until Tomo Kunisuji became the chief executive. Now things are different. Here's Mr. Tsuji.
One of our business models is licensee business, which has become the core for our overseas strategy. For a company like ours, we get paid in royalties, and in return, our characters get the exposure in the market.
I'm about to get on a Hello Kitty cable car here in Singapore. It's just one of the collaborations Sandio has agreed with several high-profile global brands. The shoe manufacturer Crocs recently added a line of Hello Kitty designs, and Starbucks used to sell Hello Kitty drinks. Those collaborations have helped Hello Kitty and other Sandio characters gain fans around the world.
In terms of sales, Hello Kitty is still our strongest character, and the two big surges in our sales throughout our history were both created by Hello Kitty. But the issue was, those jumps were not sustainable.
The revamping strategy has paid off, making Sandio profitable once again and transforming it into a $7 billion house of characters.
You can read more about how Japan's youngest CEO transformed Hello Kitty by going to bbc.com/business. Throughout the week, we've been looking at the swing states that will decide the US election next Tuesday. We've been to Pennsylvania and talked about manufacturing. We've talked about the cost of living in Nevada, the car industry in Michigan, immigration in Arizona. On Business Matters in a few hours here on the BBC World Service, we're going to Georgia to look at the issue of affordable housing, another one high up the list of concerns of voters as they decide what to do, how to cast their ballot next Tuesday. So that's later for you. But for me, Andrew Peach, and the whole team here on World Business Report, thank you for being with us here on the BBC World Service.